This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, February 20th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. How will the war on drugs change under a President Trump? Barack Obama did remarkably little to de-escalate the drug war, but Donald Trump and particularly Attorney General Jeff Sessions may step it up. Sean Dunnigan is a former intelligence research specialist at the Drug Enforcement Administration. We spoke about the Obama record on the drug war last month. Years ago when I was a reporter, I was pretty well acquainted with the head DEA guy in Louisville, Kentucky. And in some of my interviews with him, I asked him about what sort of his priorities were and what he wanted his office to focus on. And when we got to talking about cannabis, he basically dismissed it as a priority at all. And I was taken aback a little bit, but I guess I understand more now that you have limited resources. You want to prioritize those resources. Where do you think marijuana ranks in DEA's list of priorities generally?
Well, as a as a practical matter, it is a lower priority than, say, heroin or cocaine. I think there's a tacit acknowledgement among almost all people in DEA, that using marijuana does not pose the same public health risk or risk to the user that using heroin does. And so, there is an acknowledgement, I think, that it is a lower priority. However, when given the opportunity, those cases are still investigated and prosecuted. And the other problem is that, there are DEA offices all over the country and all over the world. In some of those places, it's hard to make a big cocaine bust in Topeka. It's hard to make a big heroin bust in some other smaller towns. So, you sort of have the infrastructure there to investigate drug crimes wherever that resident office may be. And in some places, marijuana is the way to make those big arrests and then affect those prosecutions. So, I think though the administrator of the DEA probably wouldn't put it this way, marijuana is the lowest enforcement priority among the drugs that are in the Controlled Substances Act. However, it is still investigated. People are still going to federal prison for marijuana crimes.
And yet in the flurry of what it's known as midnight regulating, the DEA has tightened rules about some compounds that are contained within the cannabis plant.
Yes. Yeah. Oils containing THC and oils that are used really almost exclusively for medicinal purposes. They want to make sure that the regulations are such that those substances are still clearly prohibited and interpreted as being clearly prohibited under the CSA. That was kind of a surprising move, but the agency has a lot of authority in determining that and, as any federal agency does, in deciding how laws are going to be implemented via regulation. So they certainly still care about it. It's certainly still a push. There's still anti-pot messaging that's being produced by the federal government. Arguably, it's better than the "this is your brain on drugs and just say no." But it's still out there and money's still being spent on it and people are still going to jail.
How did Barack Obama fare, in your view, with respect to the war on drugs? I know that he, to the extent that it was, I guess, politically feasible in his eyes to step down enforcement of marijuana laws in states where it was legal for some purpose. He did that, but not until late in his administration.
Yeah, it's certainly a mixed record. I think allowing states to implement their own system of regulated distribution, production and distribution, particularly for medical marijuana, but also now in eight states that will have legalized recreational marijuana use. He has given those states some latitude to implement those programs. And has not been aggressive as he could have been in prosecuting the businesses involved in that growing industry. So I think that was reasonable. However, he could have at any day during his 8 years in the White House decided to reschedule or unschedule marijuana. He could have completely put the kibosh on any federal marijuana prosecutions. So, there's an awful lot that he could have done that he didn't. I think he was okay in terms of allowing states to be those laboratories of innovation with regard to drug policy. Unfortunately, the way he went about that did not codify any law for the incoming administration. So, you know, while, you know, with the Cole memorandum written by Deputy Attorney General Cole that basically laid out enforcement priorities and directed the Department of Justice not to prioritize marijuana cases in locales where it's been legalized at the state level, you know, that can go away with a stroke of a pen 3 days from now. And so, you know, it would have been much more helpful and beneficial, you know, if the president had codified some of those changes either by law or by regulation in changing the current scheduling of marijuana under the CSA. And I suppose that he was so tentative in those reforms for political purposes. However, you know, there's growing support and now majority support for the legalization of adult use or recreational marijuana. And so, you know, I think that timidity to make any sweeping changes, I think, you know, he probably did it for political purposes, but I don't know that that was the right political calculation. I think he probably had a lot more room politically to make those changes than he chose to do.
In his various public statements about marijuana, he seemed very dismissive of the concerns of people who either just want to use it or people who want to use it for some medical purpose.
Yes, he was terribly dismissive. You know, I don't think the administration took seriously the growing body of research that shows the medical value of cannabis. And I don't think that he took seriously the problems of arrest and over-incarceration that are the result of, you know, the drug war generally, but specifically marijuana policy. And, you know, why he took that approach, I think he probably, coming into office, perceived the political liability of having admitted to be a drug user. And Democrats, of course, are always sensitive to the charge that they're being soft on crime. And so I think the path of least resistance was more or less to maintain the status quo that he found when he took the office.
The DEA has also made some noises about the drug kratom, which is a lot of people use, and it seems like there's actually a large community online of people who have discovered it. It's currently essentially legal, but what is the status of that right now, as far as you know?
Yeah, so right now it's legal. The DEA published draft regulations to schedule kratom, which would have made it illegal at the federal level. But those, as a result of a real public pushback, not only by people who use it, but also by healthcare providers, psychologists, psychiatrists, people in the treatment community, there was great pushback to those proposed regulations. And right now they're tabled, so that ban may still go into effect at some point in the future under the next administration. But currently, it's legal. And I mentioned the treatment community because one of the uses and values of kratom is that it is used during the recovery process, during detoxification from hard drugs to get users, particularly heroin users, off of that drug. And so it's really, to me, unconscionable to ban a substance like kratom that has been used for a very long time by a great number of people that shows no significant health adverse effects.
You worked at DEA. And you worked specifically in intelligence in the DEA. What did your day-to-day entail?
Sure. So there's sort of two sides to the intelligence. One is operational intelligence, which is providing direct case support. And that it means, you know, I did an awful lot of work with phone numbers and looking at metadata and also intercepted communications from Title III intercepts, working with confidential informants, working with cooperating defendants. And then a lot of computer work, you know, looking at databases to try to find people and find property and ascertain associations and activities and assets and those sorts of things. And then the other side is strategic intelligence, which I did for a few years. And that's more big picture. So it's looking at organizational profiles, who's who, drug flow analyses to find out, you know, what corridors are being used, what smuggling methods are being used, that sort of thing. And I did that for a few years in Miami, for 3 years in Guatemala City, 2 years in Mexico, 4 years as a DEA liaison to the National Drug Intelligence Center.
President Obama, as he prepared for his final week in office, opened up the degree to which the NSA may share unminimized signal data, which is information about phone calls and emails and that sort of thing, with other agencies. Is DEA on that list?
Oh, sure. Yeah, DEA was kind of a participant in that program going back to its inception. I started with DEA in March of 1998, and already we already had a joint collection program with the NSA, where we would receive periodic updates that provided metadata for essentially every international phone call that was made from the United States to another country. And so, you know, I think people tend to think of DEA as agents busting down doors, and that is certainly a lot of what they do. But there's also a pretty robust intelligence collection platform that DEA has built up that includes a lot of the bulk collection that was, you know, revealed by Snowden, obviously, and that the NSA is sort of the lead agency on. And in fact, when there's debate in Congress about expanding those authorities, and this was true during the Patriot Act, one of the arguments that representatives in support of that expansion would make would be, you know, we're just giving to counterterrorism efforts the authorities that already exist for counter-drug efforts. And that you know, that's really true if you look at, you know, the collection of phone data, metadata, but also the authority of administrative subpoenas, which are widely abused and can be used to strong arm basically any business in the country into providing information to the agency.
The Inspector General of the DEA recently issued some harsh words for the confidential informants program. First, sort of spell out what that is and what did he say?
Sure. So the Confidential Informant Program is the program under which law enforcement agencies, in this case specifically with regard to DEA, you know, use individuals to provide information that can be used in furtherance of an investigation, and in exchange for that, are actually paid cash. They're not employees of the agency, but they are acting oftentimes as agents of the agency. And DEA has thousands of confidential informants, and they range in level from people who are at really the highest levels of transnational criminal organizations to people who are at the lowest level, operating as lookouts, couriers, mules, and also people whose knowledge of what's going on in drug trafficking come not from any personal direct involvement in the trade, but just as a result of their position or associations. So people like Amtrak ticket clerks and conductors and airline gate clerks, people who, you know, are in a position to see something odd, hear things, potentially know when you know, trafficking activity may be occurring, but, you know, aren't actually involved in the trade themselves. And it can be incredibly lucrative. I mean, they can make tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars in exchange for this information.
And information that may or may not be true.
May or may not be true. It is difficult. You know, when you're paying someone to tell you something, their incentive is to tell you as much as possible. And so, you know, there's really a built-in incentive. And, you know, one of the things that was found in that audit was that the program is poorly managed, that there's insufficient oversight, that some of the provisions within the regulations, the internal DEA regulations, are being ignored and abused. To allow the agency to use people who are, you know, have demonstrably provided false information in the past, and also as a workaround around many of the internal checks and oversight mechanisms that exist, using, for instance, subsources. So, you know, say, you know, I know something about drug trafficking, but you're the signed up agent. You know, you could be paid, I could be paid sort of through you for providing that information. And the reason the agency does that is, you know, maybe I have a criminal record, right? Maybe I'm somebody that they would not want to put on the witness stand or you know, for whatever reason, I would be, because of past convictions or whatever, prohibited from participating directly in that program. Well, you still can. You just have to do it as a subsource. And that system is very much abused in the agency.
The IG, Michael Horowitz, at DEA, told Representative Tim Walberg, the DEA's policies are warping priorities by prioritizing asset forfeiture rather than the seizure of drugs, which, of course, we've seen at the state and local level, like on I believe it was I-65 in Tennessee. They seize the stuff going south, not the stuff going north. And of course, the stuff going south is money.
Yes.
The stuff going north is drugs.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, that that policing for profit model in which agencies benefit financially, agencies at all levels benefit financially from making asset seizures. But, you know, also it's easier. You know, you're less likely to get in a shootout. It's harder to make a good drug case than it is to make an asset forfeiture case. But it certainly, you know, I will say in my experience, it certainly does tend to warp enforcement priorities. I recall I was at a targeting conference at the National Reconnaissance Office, and a state police captain relayed to me, relayed to the group that, you know, one of the challenges he has with his task force, which is comprised of primarily of local law enforcement agencies in his area, was that, you know, rather than making highway interdictions of drugs, they were hitting, and this was, I think, in Kentucky, they were hitting tractor trailers, again, coming south into the state rather than Kentucky has a pretty large illicit marijuana industry. Tractor trailers coming south into the state rather than leaving the state, presumably with marijuana. And the reason was cigarette smuggling, because taxes are so onerous on cigarettes in Canada that trafficking organizations will bring, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars into Kentucky, which has a pretty low taxes on tobacco, or at least did at the time, you know, buy several hundred cartons of cigarettes and drive them up to Canada to sell. And, you know, this has nothing at all to do with why there's a drug task force in his county, but it's very easy to make those seizures. Basically, the process is, you know, you pull the driver or the courier over, you know, find the money, ask if they know about it. They're going to say no. The cop says, okay, so this isn't your money. They say no. The cop says, well, sign this piece of paper relinquishing any ownership to it. And they do. And they're generally free to go on their way, and the money goes into the coffers.
Something that I found to be really very troubling when Loretta Lynch was being confirmed or being had her hearings in the U.S. Senate before she was confirmed, she was asked about civil asset forfeiture, I believe, by Senator Mike Lee, and she did not distinguish between criminal forfeiture and civil forfeiture. She just called the broad range of forfeiture a wonderful tool, a great tool. And with the incoming Trump administration, what should we expect from Jeff Sessions, who has been, if anything, more adamant about the usefulness and beneficial qualities of civil asset forfeiture?
You know, I am not optimistic that Jeff Sessions will affect any positive reform with regard to civil asset forfeiture or, frankly, a whole lot else. But I would say I hope that there's enough congressional will and enough awareness that, you know, this is an abusive practice, that this is ultimately detrimental to enforcement efforts because it does skew enforcement priorities and how law enforcement resources are used. And, you know, I'm always hopeful that there will be some reform efforts because I do think that it is, on the face of it, an abusive practice that should be severely curtailed. But I am not optimistic that that will happen in the next attorney general.
Now, there are some members of Congress who've talked about it, but under some questioning here, they don't necessarily view the practice as abusive. They believe there are abuses, which I have interpreted to mean that they're concerned about headlines rather than the functional theft of stuff from innocent people by the government.
Right. So the argument is that the reason drug trafficking organizations are in business is to make money. And so, you know, seizing currency from them or assets from them disincentivizes drug trafficking activity. And in addition, weakens their ability to affect specific movements. You know, if you're a trafficker and every third shipment that you make, the proceeds of those are seized, you know, the argument is, well, that will change the business model. And so, you know, I agree that there may be an appropriate place for asset forfeiture in the criminal justice system. However, that appropriate place, I would argue, is post-conviction, not in lieu of conviction or in lieu of prosecution.
Back to marijuana just for a moment. You know, the president, of course, had plenary authority to deschedule or reschedule marijuana at will. You argued that rescheduling, that is adding cannabis to a lower tier of enforcement under the guidelines that are established under the Controlled Substances Act. You say that's not really a fix, though. It's a positive move, but it doesn't fix things.
Right. It doesn't, because, if marijuana, for instance, were to be rescheduled to Schedule 2, which is the most likely scenario, it still remains illegal under federal law. And, it's important to remember that cocaine is a Schedule 2 drug. And morphine is a Schedule 2 drug. And so, just rescheduling there's no attendant change to enforcement or incarceration just by rescheduling the drug. The positive aspect is that it would facilitate medical research into the medicinal value of cannabis, which currently is very much impeded by the Schedule 1 classification because, by definition, a Schedule 1 drug is one that has a high potential for abuse and no accepted medical value. And so it's very hard to obtain, for instance, federal research money to conduct clinical trials or experiments regarding the medicinal value of cannabis. It's hard to get private research money, and it's hard to get the cannabis to conduct those. So, rescheduling to Schedule 2 or Schedule 3 would be positive with regard to opening up the research. But it wouldn't do anything to kind of scale back the federal war on marijuana.
Sean Dunnigan works with the Law Enforcement Action Partnership and is a former intelligence research specialist at the DEA. Subscribe to and rate this podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.